I'm just testing to see if this thing is working. I think it is. I hate all this stuff about my face. But I'm prepared to suffer in your interests. Happy New Year! Right, that's my stuff out. Well, anyway, we're starting a new year with a new series of talks on questions that Jesus asked. These are all variously recorded in the Gospels, the first four books of the New Testament. And the question I've been given is, and it's there, is, do you still not understand? Which is a question that Jesus put to his disciples in a particular context that we will be looking at. And it's the story in question we've just had read to us, thanks Andy, is to be found in Matthew chapter 16. But the truth is, I found anyway, that in order to grasp the full context, we really should have read all the chapters 14, 15, and 16 together. But we're not doing that. What I did do was I added to the verses that I was given a few verses immediately before that recorded one dialogue, confrontational dialogue between Jesus and the Pharisees. If we can move on to the next slide. People did seem to get puzzled by Jesus' sayings quite a lot. There's quite a few examples in the Gospels of that happening. And I've given you four examples there. The first one is Nicodemus, who came to Jesus and asked for the truth of the gospel, if you like. And Jesus said, unless a man be born again, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. And Nicodemus was a bit dumb in the way he responded. He said, can a man re-enter his mother's womb? Now, if he'd exercised the intelligence he undoubtedly must have had, he would surely have understood that Jesus couldn't have been meaning being born again in a literal physical sense. It wasn't a very adult response from someone who otherwise was quite an accomplished adult. There's a publication that I read, and there was an article in it last month about 20th November, I think it was, 1963, when President John Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated. And the article was observing what I think most of us here will know, that on that same day, two quite prominent figures also died, but their deaths got no coverage because of the colossal story of the assassination of Kennedy. One of these was Aldous Huxley, the famous novelist who wrote, among other things, Brave New World. And the other was C.S. Lewis, a name that is very familiar, of course, to us as a group of Christians. They both died on the same day as John F. Kennedy, but it's not such a well-known thing. And this article was interesting because it was saying, although Kennedy was such a towering figure in the midst of the Cold War and who had handled with supreme diplomatic and political skill the awful threat of the Cuban crisis just a year before he was killed, and had, if you like, set the tone for a legacy of liberal democracy that was an example to be followed and developed, much of what he stood for in those respects has not progressed at all, and we're arguably in a less comfortable position now, politically and policy-wise, than was the case, notwithstanding the great influence that he exercised. Aldous Huxley wrote that famous novel and many other novels and was quite a figure in his time, but as the article puts it, he tends only to be quoted now, but not actually read. Whereas, by contrast, the influence 60 years on of C.S. Lewis remains very strong, and the whole range of his works, including the very famous children's books set in Narnia, but so much more of his oeuvre is still read today and influential in thought, not just in Christian thought, but in the apologetic debate of the position of the Christian message and where it should be in the modern world. And it's just interesting, I found that article, and if we can put up the separate thing that I photographed, thanks Ruth, it's up there. And the reason that I fixed on this when I was thinking about Nicodemus was because here's what C.S. Lewis said in Mere Christianity, and it's written up there. There's no need to be worried by facetious people who try to make the Christian hope of heaven ridiculous by saying they do not want to spend eternity playing harps. The answer to such people is that if they cannot understand books written for grown-ups, they should not talk about them. All the scriptural imagery, harps, crowns, gold, etc., is, of course, a mere symbolical attempt to express the inexpressible. People who take these symbols literally might as well think that when Christ told us to be like doves, he meant we were to lay eggs. And it's humorously and it's so powerfully put. And I think Nicodemus was falling into that sort of trap. And Jesus then had to work hard to develop his thinking about being born again. And of course, John chapter 3 is where we would find how Jesus developed that particular aspect of his teaching for Nicodemus's benefit. And we're not looking at that today. I'm only giving you that as an example. And there's three more examples there. And the rate I'm going through them, we're not actually going to get to my topic. But there was one hard teaching in John chapter 6. That's where Jesus said these difficult words, eat my flesh and drink my blood, which sounds like cannibalism. And the disciples responded by saying, this is a hard teaching. Well, there I'm with them. It was a tough one. We're not going to go into John chapter 6 and what all that meant today. It's only an example of how people could be puzzled by what Jesus said. Go back to his childhood. When he was a boy of 12, he lingered in the temple talking to all the old men with beards about the Old Testament and about God, the Supreme Father. And his parents had to go back and hunt for him. And he said to them, do you not understand that I must be about my Father's business? And it records that Mary and Joseph didn't understand what he meant. And I must say, I kind of don't blame them. And then just in the chapter before the one we're looking at, the disciples, Jesus was talking with the Pharisees, and the issue was that the Pharisees were complaining that the disciples didn't wash their hands before eating. Now, I think the Pharisees were not engaging in a hygiene discussion there, but in a discussion about what their rules were, and these rules were not being properly obeyed because there was no hand washing before eating. And Jesus said to the disciples who were asking for this to be explained, he said to them, why are you so dull? What he was talking about was this, that it's not what we take in through our mouths and which proceeds to nourish us and then eliminate waste. He said, it's not that that makes us defiled. Rather, it's what we say or what we do, what comes out of us is what defiles us. And the disciples had a bit of trouble understanding that concept. So these are my examples, and we're not now, let's come to the one, the actual question that I've been given to address today. And if we go to, thank you, Ruth, I've got four aspects of the context there that need to be looked at. And the wider one was that in chapters 14 and 15, you'll find the stories of first the feeding of the 5,000 and then of the feeding of the 4,000. And of course, these are chauvinistic numbers because these are numbers of the men that were present. And it says, besides women and children. And the chances are that it would have been more than double that number in total. And I have to say, I'm not all that approving of the Bible's assumption that it's only the men that count so far as the statistics of participation in these miracles were concerned. But anyway, that's by the by. The thing is, in the feeding of the 5,000, basketfuls of fragments of the bread and fish were gathered up, 12 baskets full. Now, a basket's quite a big thing, and so you can imagine that there's quite a lot of surplus that was available for, I don't know, a consumption in due course or distribution to others who weren't present or whatever. And with the feeding of the 4,000, there had been 7 baskets full gathered up. So that's the background, and that's the wider background. Come a bit closer to the actual event that we were looking at today, and there have been 2 confrontations with the Pharisees. One we have just mentioned about the washing of hands before a meal. And the other, the one that immediately triggered this incident that we are studying today that led to this question, was that the Pharisees came and confronted Jesus and said, give us a sign. And out of those contexts came the incident we're looking at. Then we come to the inner, and the word inner doesn't really work. I was on an alliteration there with ER at the end of all my words, so I just came up with inner. But it's not really, it's more like immediate or on the spot or whatever. But the context there was that the disciples had forgotten to take any bread with them where they were going. And I find that quite interesting. It's a kind of interesting detail that in the midst of its cosmic message, the Bible can still give us little details like that that somehow add to the authenticity and the sense of understanding of the relatively trivial incidents that gave rise to the messages that we appreciate today and which influences and indeed changes our lives if we're followers of Christ. We forgot the bread. And then shortly afterwards, we go to Caesarea Philippi, where Jesus asks his disciples, who do you say that I am? And Peter's response is, you are the Messiah. Now, Peter was presumably there and not, and among the disciples that Jesus had to get a bit frustrated with in the story that we're looking at today. And yet, just less than a chapter's worth later, Peter is responding to possibly the biggest question he was ever asked in his life and giving this amazing answer, courageous answer, that you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. So anyway, back to the question. We forgot the bread. Can we go to the next one, please? And Jesus' message to the disciples, or his command to them, was you need to guard against the yeast of the Pharisees. And they, what on earth did he mean? Well, I'll offer you 2 possibilities. One is that yeast of the Pharisees is just another word for bread. He wasn't saying anything more than guard against the bread of the Pharisees. Now, that's not helping us all that much, because what does the bread of the Pharisees mean any more than the yeast of the Pharisees? Or are we to treat yeast as implying some sort of unscheduled or uncontrollable expansion? That the thing about yeast is that if you put it into something, it makes things bigger. In baking, I'm told that that's what happens in baking, or making bread, that the yeast makes it rise. And therefore, what you started with was small and flat, but you end up with something that's ballooning up there. And Jesus' teaching might be that you've got to watch what the Pharisees do or say, because it may sound like a small thing, but in no time it will explode and take you over if you don't watch. So you can take either of these. Either way, the disciples were puzzled, and they said to themselves, "We forgot the bread. Is that why he's talking about guarding against the yeast of the Pharisees?" And this was the wrong answer, as Jesus was quick and careful to point out to them. And he made 3 points, or at least I'm saying he made 3 points. I'm drawing 3 points out of his response. One was, this is what he actually said, "Remember these feeding miracles that were only a couple of days ago, each of them, or a few days ago? Do you not remember we fed 5,000 people and you picked up 12 baskets full of fragments? Never mind what people had eaten. Do you remember the feeding of the 4,000 men plus women and children? And you picked up 7 basketfuls. Surely," I think Jesus was saying to them, "surely you can see that the supply of bread is not going to be a problem. So the fact that you forgot the bread isn't what this issue is about." Now, I'm slightly tentative about offering you that explanation, because Jesus was always careful, and we've got an example that we're going to come to. He was not into party tricks. He did not perform miracles for the fun of it in order to show off, even though he may well have had the power to do that. And so if he was rebuking his disciples and saying, "Look, you've seen me do miracles, so bread can appear from nowhere," that sounds to me a wee bit as though Jesus might have been suggesting to them that he would just click his fingers and bread would appear. So I'm slightly tentative about putting that to them, but I think the message that he was putting across is perfectly fair. You've seen enormous, stunning things happen. If I'm saying something about the yeast guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, I'm not just giving you a shopping tip about where you should go to find bread if you've forgotten it. I'm not just saying to you the Pharisees are bad suppliers because their bread is poor. I'm not trying to say to you that the Pharisees source their bread from unprincipled places. I'm not saying to you that the Pharisees exploit slaves in order to produce their bread, and therefore you shouldn't buy their bread because it's unethical. If that's what you think I'm getting at, then you need to think again. If we'd been reading Mark's account of this story, that's as far as it went. But happily, we're reading from Matthew, and Matthew adds an extra line, which is, "Then once Jesus rebuked them in that way, they understood that what he was talking about was the teaching of the Pharisees that they were to guard against." And maybe that's where the yeast comes in, that if you buy into what the Pharisees teach in a small way, it might become a major thing and take over your life in a way that is not healthy. Because, and this takes me to the second bullet point there, what Jesus seemed to be saying was that The kingdom of God is about principles and not rules. It's not as such about keeping the laws, although the laws are important. We would need to read a lot more together to understand that Jesus was not being radical in the sense that he was ripping up the Old Testament's rules, but he was pointing out that keeping rules doesn't say anything about someone's heart. You can keep rules and not be capable of being accused of breach of them, but at the same time, you're not really honoring the purpose for which the rules were made. And in the first confrontation with the Pharisees that I've mentioned, that's what he's on about. He was saying, you're making a big fuss about washing your hands, but the truth is that cleanliness in the true moral sense isn't about the physicalities of eating and drinking. It's about what's in your heart and how your heart motivates what you speak and say and how your heart motivates what you do. So it's the principles that count. And compared to what's in your heart and what motivates you, whether you wash your hands or not in advance of a meal is trivial by comparison with that particular truth. So he was saying, guard against these, the Pharisees, if what they're trying to get you to do is keep a whole lot of rules, but they're not actually speaking into your heart and what sort of a person you truly are. The principles of who you are more important. Governments make rules. That's the only thing they're there for, at least that's what they think they're there for. The Scottish government's been given it's been attacked and criticised because in the last year, I think it is, they've passed fewer bits of legislation than any Scottish government since the turn of the century when the Scottish government was first brought into being. And that's a bad thing. I don't actually personally think that. I think that it would be wonderful if we got a new government in Scotland and said, we are not going to pass any more rules, we are not changing anything, we're going to manage with what we've got, and we're just going to disband the Parliament for the next 5 years and manage with the law system we already have. I think that I would stand as a candidate on that platform. But you see, bad behavior is noticed by governments and politicians, and they want to get voted back in, so they have to pass rules that address what they think is a bad thing. And that way they hope that they'll get better behavior by the populace at large. And of course, they don't. I'm in a golf club, not because I'm any good at golf, but because I'm in a golf club. And I got sucked into a subcommittee to rejig the club's rules. Honestly. So I've been through endless meetings of this little group, trying to rewrite the rules in a manner that is going to be helpful. And so we now have a huge list of rules. And one chapter of the rules is about discipline and what's to happen if you break the rules. And there always was this feeling that if somebody was undesirable or behaved badly within the club, they should get kicked out or should be suspended or whatever. But now we've got a string of about 50 rules that people have got to comply with. And that's just the way it has to go if you're going to do this sort of thing. But I can't help feeling that it's not going to change the behavior of the badly behaved members of this club. They're still going to be badly behaved. It's just that we'll now need to try and find the right rule to pin on them for having broken. But it won't actually be making Bearsden Golf Club a place of moral beauty in a way that it wasn't before. You follow me? And although we're smiling, There's a very important point here that rules, and this is what governments, I think, never understand. Rules don't change people. They don't. You still need to have them, but they don't change them. And of course, with rules, you've got clever people, allegedly clever people like lawyers, who are out there just to find ways of swerving around the rules so that you can do all the bad stuff, but are able to show that you actually haven't broken any of the rules and therefore it's okay. That's what lawyers are about. They're a hopeless lot. Third bullet point, faith, not magic. Jesus refused to give, when it was demanded of him, he refused to give the Pharisees a sign from heaven. Now, I think the Pharisees almost certainly knew he would refuse, and that's why he asked them. They thought they were fairly sure that Jesus wasn't a circus performer, and that if they asked him for a sign, they were fairly sure in advance, I feel, that he would decline. And so what they were wanting to trap him into doing was saying, no, I won't give you a sign. And then they would say, ah, well, you can't eat it. All these stories you've heard about you feeding the 5,000 and so on, it's just rubbish. If it was true, show us. And they were out to discredit Jesus' reputation by demanding something that people have said, have you heard about this guy? He heals people. He feeds people. And they weren't happy with this, so they thought, we know he's not actually going to do this to order, so let's order him to do it and see what happens. And then when he says no, we'll say he can't do it. He's a charlatan. I think that's what they were about. That's how it makes most sense to me. And so he walked away from them after saying that demanding a sign is actually itself a sign of an insufficiently informed or an insufficiently thinking person. That signs and miracles are not of themselves the kind of thing that are likely to persuade the sincere inquirer to turn and follow. Now, that was, again, a very big thing and a big message for Jesus to be seeking to put across in a context where life was difficult and where poverty was rampant and where disease and illness was all over the place and very difficult to survive. But that was his message. I've only got 4 minutes left, so we'll stop there because I want to move on to my last slide. I mean, we'll stop at that bit. I had more to say. You'll be disappointed to know you're not going to get it because I want to move to this final slide. We need to know who are today's Pharisees, the yeast of whose yeast we need to be on our guard against. Is it church leaders? Well, I mean, I suppose in a sense the Pharisees, they were the religious leaders of the day. But I'm not sure that church leaders are actually today's equivalents. The church has been marginalized in our Western society to a large extent. And what church leaders say, even someone as prominent and as authoritative and as well-respected as the moderator of the Church of Scotland or the Archbishop of Canterbury, what they say does not persuade or carry people with them in the way that perhaps 100 years ago it might have done. I think that's the reality. So I'm not sure that we should be, that we are to be on our guard against what the church leaders might say. Not because they're perfect and because what they say is necessarily good and worth following or worth going with, but because they're not commanding the same automatic readiness to follow that you might used to be the case. So that I would say it's rare for a church leader to be in that sort of position these days. Politicians, well, you're maybe picking up a wee bit that they're not the range of people that I've got the highest regard for. But occasionally, they might be Pharisees whose word we need to be careful about. Moving on, I think heroes or celebrities are, oddly enough, it seems to me, more in a position of commanding people who admire them to think the way they do and to do what they want us to do. I think it seems to me that whenever there is an issue out there, those for or against that issue want to trot out their heroes and celebrities that everybody's heard of to support the view. And somehow the message seems to be, if that's what these superstars think, have you got any business thinking anything else? Drives me mad. But it's actually, I think, true. There's a truth there. I think there's a bigger frequency of celebrity direction of how people should think and act than there is from church leaders, and certainly largely than of politicians. My fourth example is the one which I think is the most insidious and probably the strongest, and I'm calling it the secular consensus, because there is now, it seems to me, abroad a kind of assumed rightness of what you might call the atheistic position. We don't need religion anymore. We don't need to hear what the church says. Christianity is dead. Christians are silly people who are adhering to something that is historic and finished. I've got one example, assisted dying. Now, I'm not offering you my view on this. I'm just observing that this is an issue that is current, and it's one that is live, and there is legislation, I think, already before the Scottish Parliament that is going to be voted upon. recently in the Herald, there was an article by one of its journalists, who, it seems to me, never misses an opportunity to tell everybody who's reading his stuff that he's an atheist. And his viewpoint on the assisted dying bill was very much in favor of it. And his remark was, I don't mind religious people, I don't mind Christians having a different view if that's how they feel. Just don't try to shove that on me. That's not relevant. The religious point of view is not relevant. And he then proceeded rather contemptuously to be dismissive of those who, from a Christian or a more widely religious point of view, might disagree with him on the basis that, well, they actually haven't got an argument. A day or two later, there was a letter taking the opposite view published in the Herald, and it was cogently argued against the assisted dying bill, and it was submitted by someone who, I think he was a medical practitioner, and belonged to an organization called Humanists Against the Assisted Dying Bill. And his arguments were rather like the initial journalist, quite cogent, but this time against the bill. But what was very interesting was he said, I entirely agree with the journalist that religion is irrelevant here. And so the message from both of these individuals was, if we're going to have a moral debate, we don't need Jesus. Now, that wasn't the language they used, but that's what they meant. We don't need Jesus. And if you're a Christian, well, you might be a beekeeper, or you might be in a golf club. You can be a Christian if you want, but that's the status as that we are according you. It's the same as just having a silly wee interest that might give you kicks, but it's not relevant to an assessment of the great moral issues of the day. And that was coming from both sides of this debate on assisted dying. And I'm not offering you a side of my own in relation to that debate. I'm observing that that was the agreed view that these different points of view, that was the agreed view they had on the place of the Christian viewpoint. In effect, they were saying, we'll judge you as, if you're a Christian, we'll judge you. We'll put you in a wee box that keeps you out of the road. But don't you dare judge us, seemed to be the message. And that, to me, it seems to me that that's the thing that perhaps we're being called to. If we're Christians, we need to beware of that sort of yeast, because it seems to me that it's invading most areas of public thought. And I think the message for Christians is we should be resisting this. We should be insisting upon the Christian viewpoint being made known. A few weeks before this, there had been another issue. Someone had written into the Herald about all the terrible things were happening in Israel and, oh, the awfulness of COVID, and where was God in all this? And he was quoting, I think it was Woody Allen, who said that the thing about God is he's an underachiever. He doesn't solve all these problems that we have. And I saw a letter, which was one of the best letters I think I've ever seen, written in riposte to this. I'm sure it was the best letter I've ever seen offered to the Herald, and they didn't print it, despite my best efforts. They didn't print it. So that was my attempt, if you like, not in relation to the assisted dying. I wondered if I should be trying to get myself printed again, but I was kind of furious at the way they wouldn't print that beautiful letter I'd sent previously about the other one. But I do think that there is something that demands of us as Christians that we should let the Christian viewpoint be known, and we shouldn't allow the secular consensus to dictate to us how we put it. In other words, we could submit ourselves, if we're Christians, we could submit ourselves to the secular consensus and argue for what the Christian viewpoint would teach without mentioning God and without mentioning the Bible and without mentioning Jesus. We'd just say it is best to do this for the following reasons. But what we would be doing there if we did that is subordinating our Christian faith to the secular consensus and just saying we're going to play to your rules and not to our own rules. I don't know where I'm going with this. But I'm simply offering it to you as an example. There are many different ways in which there might be Pharisees' teachings in your life that you need to be aware of, and you'll know them yourself if you think about it. I'm just offering that not as my message for today in any wide sense, but simply as an example that should help us to think about what this little passage is actually teaching us if we seek to be followers of Christ. And I'll conclude now. Actually, I do have one more of these, and I'll rattle through this, because all I'm doing is concluding by going back to the three points that Jesus made to the disciples. Remember that God provides. That's the feeding miracles. God has a track record of providing. Remember principles, not rules. That it's what is in the heart that counts, and not how many boxes of compliance we can tick. And remember that it's about faith and not magic. The Christian message, the message of Jesus is follow me. That's a demand to a commitment. It's not something that is instant. Obviously, there is a first time when you say, yes, I choose to follow you. But the real truth of it lies in the following and not in the instant decision to follow. It's a steady thing. And that's not necessarily an easy sell, because what we're saying to ourselves is we must follow. And follow is a long-term thing and not something that we'll get this afternoon if we decide on it. Peter finished, the final bit of context was Peter's declaration that you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. What have we got there? What we've got is something that is even greater than a principle, namely a person. And it's the person of Jesus Christ that gives life. He's the Son of the living God. And it's helpful to remember that when we're struggling with these little things that make us sad, that what we hold so dear is kind of marginalized. It's helpful to remember that in a way it doesn't matter, because the big picture is there, and we are asked to cling to and to follow. Not simply, certainly not a set of rules, not even fine principles, better though they may be, but a person, namely the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And look at that, I'm 10 minutes over time. Thanks.